Straight out of Finland, this is the Reluctant Theologian Podcast. I am your host, Dr. R.T. Mullins from the University of Helsinki. Yes, you heard that correctly. I recently accepted a research fellowship at Helsinki's Collegium for Advanced Studies to work on my next book, From Divine Timemaker to Divine Watchmaker. In future episodes, I'll tell you all about this exciting new research project. But in today's episode, Dr. Emma Sani and I chat about my brand new book, God in Emotion, which is being published through Cambridge University Press. In this episode, we discuss the first two chapters of the book, which cover the history of the debate over impassibility, and also offers an introduction to the philosophy of emotions. If you have questions or topics that you would like to hear in the show, you can send me a message at rtmullins.com. Well, ready or not, here's Emma and I talking about God in Emotion. Enjoy!
Okay, so Ryan just wrote a new book.
A brand new book.
On it, God and Emotion. That's the title.
That's the title.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we're going to discuss two chapters of the book today.
Correct.
So I think we should start asking you why writing a book about God and Emotion.
Right. So I just already recorded an episode. We've released an episode now that is about the personal story behind it. So let's talk about the intellectual reasons behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the intellectual reasons are something like this. So most people that believe that God exists think that God is personal in some sense, which just means that God's got the exact same characteristics that a person would have, and that God is at least one person. Because if you are a Christian, you're going to say that God's Trinitarian, so you're going to say God's three persons. Mm-hmm. So he's either a person, or he's at least three, or at least one person, because he's more than one person, he's three persons. And part of what it means to be a person is you have a mental life, but you also have an emotional life. And so I'm like, okay, cool. Now, it seems like everybody's going to have to say something about the emotional life of God, but what exactly is God's emotional life like? So if God exists, which emotions would God have? And that's kind of the basis for this, is trying to figure out what's going on here. What emotions do we want to say God has? Which emotions do we want to say God does not have?
Right. Okay. So I'm a bit confused here because I would not even suspect for once that if I would worship a God, would be, of course, I would feel like it's something divine, so it'd be very different from me,
mm-hmm,
because
mm-hmm.
You create a universe, you create people, whatever.
Right.
But also would like to have someone that understand the way I feel, because, you know, most of people that even do not believe in a God, but if I go through a time of hardship,
mm-hmm.
they will start to wonder what happened to me. Is it because of God hate me, if there is such a thing? But this all implies that God is kind of related to me and interested in my life.
Right.
So I'm wondering, you say that God can have or have not emotion. That means like I could have a God is empathic or right. not empathic. And I would be find very hard to worship a God that is not feeling what I feel.
Mm-hmm.
But you say there is a very open debate, and this is the empathic idea of a God is a very new one.
Right.
So yeah. it can you please expand on this? Because it just sounds so weird.
Right. So exactly, this is exactly the big issue that I look at in the book. So you've got these two different views. You've got impassibility, which says God cannot suffer, and God can only have one emotion, which is just pure happiness. Maybe you can have some other emotions, but they got to be consistent with pure happiness.
But why have to be pure happiness? It's not just... I would understand if there is a God that doesn't feel anything.
Mm-hmm.
I would like, okay, it's just so distant from me. It is not... cannot relate it to me at all.
Right.
Because it's beyond me. And I would accept that. It's like, no emotion whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, how does it happen? This is really bothering me because it's like... No.
Where's he getting it from?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. This is too human. I'm sorry. You cannot pick whatever emotion you want.
Right.
No. It's either nothing or mm-hmm. all of them.
Right.
There's nothing in between.
Yeah. So the background assumption here is that part of what it means to be happy is to live the good life. And to live the good life on most conceptions is you've got some right relationship with whatever is the greatest good.
Because okay.
if you're in the right relationship with the greatest good, you're going to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you're a theist, you typically say that the greatest good is God. And so God's, of course, going to have like a perfectly good and right relationship with himself.
Yes.
And so
no.
that's the grounding of his happiness. That's the idea.
That makes sense that you explain this. But in my mind, if I'm thinking like a very you know, when you think about a very wise old person, you would just see them very composed and like nothing can, you know, hurt me because like I'm just beyond thing. I'm beyond everything.
Right.
So the fact that feeling like a god just like sitting in a corner and giggling all the time.
Right.
Just doesn't sound very wrong.
I mean, I don't know if it's like a giggling kind of like blissfulness, but the way it's described is this.
Okay.
It's felicity is pure bliss. It is, I mean, it's
okay,
really
just pure
over the
content.
Top.
Okay.
Contentment could be a way you could put it, but it's definitely kind of happiness. So it's not just,
okay.
So when you talk about the wise stoic, like they're not affected by anything because they're perfectly content.
Yes. Okay. Okay. You're right.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but it, with God though, it's not just like perfect contentment. It's, he's happy. He is happy. He is joyful. He is blissful.
Okay.
Yeah. Blessedness is the idea. And
right.
So that's the majority view throughout church history within Christianity.
So do you think the attraction was that I'm going to get that blissful at some point?
Mm-hmm. That's exactly it. Yeah.
Okay.
So the idea is I want to be perfectly happy.
Mm-hmm.
You do too. Who doesn't? I mean,
right.
Come on.
Of
right?
course.
Like it's not even like that's just your starting point. Like
yes.
All creatures by nature want to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
How do we get it? And so you've got all these different ethical theories and these different theories of providence and everything about how do we get that? Well, whatever the source of my happiness is, it better be something that's really stable in its happiness.
Because
if it's not stable, if it's just like constantly like fleeting around like on a whim and like it loses its happiness, that's not a stable ground for my happiness. I need a stable ground. And the most stable ground is, it, at least according to their conception of it, is one that cannot possibly lose its happiness. It cannot possibly be moved from its happiness.
Okay. So I think if I'm getting some of this happiness at some point, this sounds a very attractive God to worship.
Right.
But I have the problem that this will all come very later, like
yes.
in my afterlife.
Definitely. You're not going to get it here now.
So I'm feeling like it's going to be hard to spend all this time on this earth and, you know, okay, I have this thoughts on the back of my mind, like one day I would be very happy if I, you know, stick to this whatever good life I'm doing now and worship the God in a good way. But yeah, I think it's, I have something very, very much missing there.
Because it seems like if you really believe the idea that God is personal, and you're in this sort of God that you, not that you just could pray to, but a God that would actually care about your
yes.
prayers, then it's a God who is going to have concerns about you.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
And if he doesn't have empathy, then it's going to be like, is this really a God that could have cares and concerns about me?
Yes.
And that's something that you start to see a huge shift in the 20th century. So in the latter half of the 20th century, after
yes.
World War II, there's a massive shift, and it's what's called the New Orthodoxy. So impassibility is overwhelmingly the dominant view throughout all of church history. You've got some couple people dissenting here and there, but once you get after World War II, it just flip-flops completely.
Mm.
And the people who affirm passibility, that God can suffer, that God can have a wide range of emotions, God can have empathy, because
okay.
that's always been denied in the past. God cannot have empathy. But now it's like God literally has empathy. And some people really push it up in this really extreme way. Like he's got this maximal empathy for you.
Okay.
That becomes the new orthodoxy.
Okay, so we have this historical shift in yes. the 1900s.
Yes.
And how do you point this out?
So one of the things that I noticed in a lot of these discussions, it was actually kind of annoying, some people were talking about is just the great tragedy of World War II and this horror and this chaos.
I'm sure there were war before that.
Right.
Come on.
No, there was no suffering in humanity
before
World War II.
I'm just saying World War One. That
World
was
War
like pretty recent before World War II, and I'm pretty sure there was a lot of suffering. And then, oh my God, I cannot even think about, I mean, all humankind history is like war.
There was no suffering on a mass
plague,
scale before
that. Illness, diseases.
No.
Okay.
None of that mattered.
Nothing.
It was only the horrors of World War II. And so what I noticed though was I just thought, well, that's just silly because A, it's missing like the actual arguments that are at play,
sure.
which I go through in the book. But also B, I trace the history back further.
Mm-hmm.
So what I discovered, where I start with my book is I start with the year 1900 because there's a guy named Marshall Randalls in England who is actually really disturbed by a whole bunch of people who are wanting to reject impassibility. And so he writes a book that's published in 1900 going, we need to defend impassibility. And that obviously entails that, well, there's people before that rejecting impassibility. And so he's responding to a couple different things, primarily to this group in Ireland. There's a group of theologians that wrote some collected volume in Ireland that I was not able to get a hold of that he's responding to. And this kicks off this debate from 1900 to about 1930. A bunch of different people in Scotland and in England and in Indiana, and then some random guy in Germany that only gets mentioned here or there.
Okay.
And so they start debating this issue of what exactly is God's emotional life like? Mm-hmm. Does God suffer? And so it starts before you even get into World War I and World War II.
Okay.
So I was like, okay, hang on. The history actually goes back before the 1900s. And then major thinkers start picking up on these themes before then. And there's also some paper I was not able to track down written by George Orwell that also creates a huge stir on this issue.
Oh, I can bet.
Yeah, because George Orwell, he's always creating a huge stir.
Of course.
Yeah, but the way people were citing things at that point is really annoying because they're like, well, as according to Mr. Orwell, as we all know, and they quote this thing, and I'm like, but what's the citation? Like, what's the paper? And I couldn't
find it. You know, at the time they were... The literature was more limited than now. So they were like, come on, you didn't see this thing? It just came out right now. One of these 10 things have been published these years.
Right.
Right. Now you're like, a million things published this year. So good luck with that.
Exactly. Yeah. So when I get to this end of this time period, there's this guy named Mosley who writes this history of impassibility. And he ends it really with these debates that take place in the 19... They kind of like peter out in the 1920s in his mind. And he just mentions like Francis McConnell in Indiana. He mentions Bertrand Brasnett in Scotland, Marshall Randall's in England. And he's like, and that pretty much settles the entire debate. You know, like, that's it. Like, and he's like, this is a massive controversy of these three people. You know, and you're like, oh, cool. All right.
But these three people, they feels to me that like on a fringe.
It might seem like they're on the fringe, but the way these debates are taking place is if like they're on the cutting edge.
Okay.
And then when I fast forward just a couple years after that, there's this guy in America who is English, but he moves to America, named Arthur W. Pink. And Pink, he is really upset about this. And he starts talking about this modern view of passibility. Is this effeminate God that's just ruining society? Is the way, because he's also a preacher of a particular sort. So he's got this very like heated rhetoric. So it seems like it's a really heated thing. And then I start seeing other models of God start popping up. Again, before World War II. So you see process philosophy start to pick up just before that. And that really emphasizes this idea that God has all the emotions that you have. He feels everything you feel, even more than what you feel, according to a lot of process thinkers. So that's like a much stronger view than what some of these other people in the early like 20s and were thinking. Because they're like... God feels for you, suffers for you, he suffers with you. And other people go, no, he can't possibly. But then these process thinkers are like, he feels everything you feel, but more so, more than you feel.
Okay.
And so this all, then you get, when you get into after World War II, you see a lot of people going, if God witnessed the Holocaust, if he witnessed the gulags, if he witnessed, you just name any atrocity.
Yes.
And he's just like, I'm fine, I'm perfectly happy. They're like, that's disgusting.
It is.
And I feel that guttural reaction. At the same time, you also have different methods of biblical scholarship taking place where they're going, we're going to do our best to not bring our philosophical assumptions to the table and just try to see what is really being claimed here. And when you do that, you see God claiming on almost every single page that he's upset by stuff.
Yes.
He's happy by stuff.
Exactly. That's what I was about to ask you because it's like, if I'm, well, I'm not a great Bible reader, as you know, but sorry. But you know, even if you're not certified Christian, you know that the Bible, the God in the Bible is always angry at people. And anger is an emotion.
Yeah.
So I'm feeling like, how can you say he's perfectly happy? Because I don't know much of it, but I'm feeling like God's always punishing human to behaving badly. And he have always some hate against them because they should know better by then because they've been told so many times.
Right.
So how can you reconciliate that?
And that's one of the issues I get into in the book later, because there's a psalm that explicitly says God feels indignation every day towards sin.
Wow.
And you're like, well, okay, that seems like if he feels indignation, can you really be perfectly happy if you're feeling indignation towards sin every day? And it's like, well,
sounds hard.
It sounds hard.
Yes.
And so that's a really important biblical theme that I'm like, maybe we should consider this.
Mm-hmm.
And during the 20th century, you see a lot of biblical scholars just go, you cannot claim to affirm the biblical view of God and say God is impassible. And so that becomes another big growing point of contention. So it's not just simply, oh, the World War II was awful, you know, and people just like, they felt terrible. So they're like, God's got to feel terrible too. People are going, but the Bible has a very clear statement about what God is like.
Okay, so which timeline we are talking about here now?
So we're still just in the 20th century at this point.
Okay.
And that's the kind of debates that are going.
Yes.
And so that's like how I start the book, is just going, here's a little bit of history here. Mm-hmm. We're living in an age where passibility, the idea that God suffers, he's got this range of emotions, he has empathy, that has been the dominant view for several decades. But when we get into the 21st century, and over the last few decades, I've started to see more and more like papers and books coming out wanting to say, hang on, we need to go back to the classical view of impassibility.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of point this out, is in the year 1900, when Marshall Randles says, oh gosh, all these people are saying God suffers, they're affirming passibility.
Mm-hmm.
He says, this is a passing mood.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going anywhere.
Yes.
This is just a blip in history. It's going to go right back to impassibility right away. But he felt strong enough about it, the issue, he'd write a book against it.
Yeah, I have a question here, mm-hmm. because I'm feeling that, don't you think there is like a discrepancy between what theologians think mm-hmm. and what people think?
Yes.
Because I'm pretty sure that, as I say, I'm agnostic,
mm-hmm.
but grown up Catholic.
Right.
Yeah. In Italy, I have no choice.
Right.
Anyway, I always felt like when I was just going to church, when I was very young, I always have this thing very clear in my mind that, you know, whatever I'm going through, God is there with me. And it's just kind of relief. So I'm really mm-hmm. feeling like normal people have this sort of view that God is like with you and empathic with you and just what you give you the strength to go through the hard moment.
Yes.
So I find it very hard to believe that this debate took so long
mm-hmm.
to come up.
It is a struggle for me, especially like, so when I first started working on this project several years ago, I would go home and like tell some of my people at church, they're like, okay, what are you working on right now? And I'm like, oh, I want to talk about God's emotions. They're like, okay, cool. What's that? And I'm like, well, the majority of you throughout church history said God cannot suffer and he's only perfectly happy. And the common response I would get was, didn't people read the Bible in the past?
Yes.
And I would always laugh and be like, they did. They did.
Okay.
They're trying really hard, but they've got this different, like under, like some different background assumptions. And they're like, what? You
so,
know. Yeah.
So my question is, mm-hmm. like, when do you think this divergence start to happen? Like what people have been have been told from preacher and what preacher actually think? Because I'm feeling like there is a massive division there, because I'm pretty sure if I'm tell anybody I know that goes to church and I will tell them like, you know, God doesn't suffer with you, they would be like horrified.
Yeah.
So when this division, I don't know, is this one of these things that is like when you're trapping your philosophy, you're so far away from people?
Yes. I think that's really what's going on, because when I study, for instance, like the history of art mm-hmm. Throughout the Western world, and you see lots of different depictions, there's a lot of depictions of Jesus suffering, and that's a huge theme in a lot of Christian art.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
That is very true, mm-hmm. because, you know, as I say, Italian, lots of art history in churches mm-hmm. that have been studied at school,
right.
and Jesus is always, like, incredibly, like, suffering on the cross, mm-hmm. and you really feel, like, this huge pain coming from paintings and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so it's a major emphasis. But the theologians, in their ivory tower, they always had an easy way to explain this. They'd be mm-hmm. like, right, God suffers, God the Son suffers only in his human nature,
right.
not his divine nature.
Okay, that's true, because you were saying before there are like three persons.
Mm-hmm.
So is this like a way to, I don't know, kind of process this
mm-hmm.
different emotional level that
yes.
God should have but shouldn't have?
Yes. And there's a lot of fancy footwork. Billy Abraham, this Irish theologian that I love, there's this way he would talk about fancy footwork in a kind of derogatory term. He's like, you can affirm this view, but there's a lot of fancy footwork you can do to, you know, to try to defend it. And that was usually his term for, like, you could do lots of, like, intellectual gymnastics in order to do that if you really want to. Sometimes I think that's what's going on.
Okay.
So here's an example of a contemporary thinker. So Eleanor Stump, she's a contemporary Catholic philosopher, mm-hmm. and she affirms impassibility. And so I look at her view of love at some point later on in the book. And so her view, though, is that in order to really love another person, you have to have some kind of mutual closeness. You have to have empathy for the other mm-hmm. person. And she's like, well, crap, we've got a problem here. Well, she would never say crap because she just doesn't think you should use such language
obviously.
When you're doing philosophy.
Bad on you. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
So she's like, que pale. What do I do? She's like, I have to get God empathy somehow. And she's like, well, God can't have empathy. Mm-hmm. She's like, the human nature of Jesus, though, he can have empathy.
Okay.
And so I see she does a lot of fancy footwork. To try to get God empathy somehow through the incarnation. But ultimately what you get is you don't empathize with God. You're only empathizing with the human nature of Jesus.
Yes, because also I have the feeling that Jesus, when incarnate, it was a very short time period. It was 33 years.
Right.
Yeah. Kind of, roughly.
Yeah, give or take a year or two. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm feeling like in the whole history of humanity, that's a very, very small right. period. And I'm feeling like, that's all the empathy you had for like 30 years? Mm-hmm.
So there's two ways that someone like Eleanor can get out of this. So first she can say, on the cross, God takes all of human suffering, all of human sin, all of human shame, all these things, and dumps it onto the human nature of Jesus on the cross at that moment.
Okay, no, I respect that. Mm-hmm. But because it's a limited time.
It's still limited time.
I'm feeling like any suffer after that doesn't matter.
Mm. Right.
Mm-hmm. It's like, what are you going to do with that? I mean, mm-hmm. the fact like I'm in pain constantly because I have some weird diseases. So
right.
what is that?
Yeah, it's like, so what?
And so what?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another thing she could say is, well, God... the son still could empathize with you right now in his human nature.
But
again, still, so what? And this actually brings up another issue that I don't discuss in the book, though, is but I'm going to talk about in a forthcoming paper that I'm working on for a handbook of philosophy of religion on impassibility.
What is the title of the paper?
It's at the moment, it's just impassibility and evil.
Okay.
Because it's going to be in the section on the problem of evil mm-hmm. in a forthcoming handbook on philosophy of religion. So there is this claim you see in the 20th century that only the suffering God can help. And somehow the assertion, so my friend Tasia Scruton, she's pointed out that it's actually just some political things going on behind the scenes. So it's not just simply if God suffers, then that takes care of the problem of evil. Mm-hmm. But there are a bunch of thinkers who misunderstood the political context of the statement from this guy named Bonhoeffer, who makes the statement only the suffering God can help. And they take it to be, well, the problem of evil, the fact there's suffering in the world, is just solved, presto, by the fact that God suffers with you. And a bunch of people who affirm impassibility go, no, okay, great, so God suffers with you, and so what? Well, that's just more people suffering. Mm-hmm. That does nothing.
See, I'm feeling this issue working in both ways. Mm-hmm. Because if you establish that God doesn't have any emotion, but it's just perfectly bliss, mm-hmm. I can live my life through suffering and feel like, okay, nobody will empathize fully with me.
Yep.
But in my new life, when I get resurrected, mm-hmm. I'll be perfectly blessed as God
right.
and be perfectly happy. That's kind of attractive way to think of, right?
It can be, yeah.
It really is because like, okay, this life sucks, but I'll be promised a very good one afterwards. Right. So I can see why people are attracted to this model. Mm-hmm. And the other model, obviously, I'm feeling more like, okay, I'm suffering. I have God that's constantly suffered with me. Mm-hmm. So I feel like, okay, I have like a sort of empathy all the way through. And obviously, when I will be resurrected, I'll be fine anyway, mm-hmm. because that's where the story goes. So I'm feeling like I can see why these two models, they can be both attractive.
And attractive and also other things why anybody on either side would go, I don't like that.
Because in mm-hmm. the end, I mean, if you look at the end point, it's the same.
Oh, with regards to the eschaton?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
It really is. Mm-hmm. So it's just a matter of, is this life worth enough or not? Mm-hmm. Is this suffering in this life meaningful mm-hmm. or not?
Yes.
Because I'm feeling that if it's not meaningful, like to make me grow as a person or whatever more implication you want to put on, I really feel like that God will be there with me. But if it has no meaning, because it's like, you're going to be blissed anyway at some point.
Yeah.
I'm feeling like it doesn't matter if God cares for me or not.
Yeah.
Because it will give me a perfect life at some point.
So I might as well just kind of like, well, I guess since we're in the UK, I could just say, I'll just have a stiff upper lip. Just get on, carry
on. Exactly. Just power through.
Yeah.
And you will just get it at some point.
Yes.
Or you prefer a God that's like, yeah, patting your back all the time.
Right.
I don't know. I feel like why both models are attractive.
And so when I enter into this discussion, this is exactly what I see. The sort of like the discourses on this level. And I'm like, we can do better. We can do better. I can identify some real arguments that are at play. I can extend those arguments to some like beyond some other levels and really try to develop arguments for and against each view that people haven't paid enough attention to. And so that's ultimately what I want to do in the book is just go, all right, we've got these two different views. This is an introduction to these two different views. Let's look at some arguments for and against so that way people can make up their own mind.
Right.
Not based on the standard rhetoric that they're used to hearing, but really trying to push through, power through to some new interesting arguments.
So, okay, on this case, for me, the biblical account that God is always angry, punishing people, it really kills. It really kills the impassibility.
Yeah, it seems like it would, yeah.
But, so how can people get out of that?
Right. So the impassibility view, they've got some options here. So one of the things that they'll say is, well, maybe it's like a, maybe it's a kind of happy wrath. Like, he is really genuinely angry at your sin. But but it's still consistent with his perfect happiness.
It's just like, why did you do that thing? You should know better.
Yeah.
No, okay, I'll give you a good birdie spunk.
Right.
I don't know.
It was odd to me. So
I know, I can't really see.
Yeah,
that.
So there's this guy named William Shedd, who I look at. He's this American theologian from the 1800s, and he's absolutely brilliant. And he's like, God has two emotions, love and wrath. And then later on, he sneaks in this idea of like, which emotions does God literally have? He's like, the only emotions God literally has are the ones that are consistent with pure happiness. And you're like, you told me he had two emotions. Now you got, you know, and so I'm like, okay, whatever.
That's confusing.
So it's confusing, but I'm like, okay, so God's got more than just the two that Shedd wants to say because he says God has pure happiness. So I'm like, love and wrath. So he thinks wrath is really important, but wrath has got to be consistent with God's perfect happiness.
Okay.
And so I'm like, okay, cool. So God's got a happy wrath. How does that work? That seems, if I'm wrathful,
angry. It's like a lot of negative emotion associated with that.
Exactly.
Happiness, I feel like, is positive things coming out of it. So I don't know how you can put them together. Can you explain this better?
He doesn't explain enough. And so what I do is I point out is there are a lot of different people who are classical theists who want to affirm impassibility, who will say, no, we got to get rid of God having wrath.
Okay.
And say he doesn't literally have this emotion. But they still want to say he's metaphorically got the emotion.
Okay.
And so I remember earlier I mentioned this guy named Arthur W. Pink, who had this really like fiery sort of rhetoric of like, these people believing in this effeminate God who has all these emotions in this, you know. And
wow.
Like, and so it's he's living in a different era.
Very different.
A different era. Because I remember I presented this paper on him in St. Andrews. You were there actually for that. When I said like, when I was quoting him of saying like this effeminate God, seeing like this particular professor in the background, she was like, like she just wanted to throw up.
Cringing. Yeah.
Anyway, so Pink has this really fiery rhetoric, but he's got this point. He's like, if you do not believe in God's wrath towards sin, if you do not really believe that God is upset or despises sin, then you don't really believe in a God who is perfectly holy, perfectly moral, and perfectly just. And he's like, you do not have the right attitude towards all of God's attributes.
Yeah, no, but okay, so is it possible, like, if I'm feeling very happy and then, okay, let's say you break a glass and I'm just completely happy coming in the room and you see you breaking a glass and it's a glass that, I don't know, was gifted from my grandmother and I had so much attachment to the glass, but I'm like, okay, I'm happy right now. And then you broke this glass and I'm like, Ryan, you should be more attentive to this. And I got mad on you.
Yeah.
But then I'm like, I rise above, it's fine, it's just a glass.
Right.
Is that what God could be possibly doing?
No. So this is actually gets at the heart of a couple different issues of what exactly emotions are and then what it means for God to be impassible.
Mm.
Because part of what it means for God to be impassible is that God cannot be influenced or moved or affected by anything outside of himself.
Oh,
and so this sort of story where you've just, where you've walked into the room, you've seen this glass, you've already valued this glass because it was from your grandmother. So it's got this sort of sentimental value. God couldn't have that. He couldn't have sentimental value towards anything outside of himself.
I would feel very... I don't know how you can have feelings of anger, of happiness.
Right.
If you're not attached to something or someone.
Yes. So let's talk about emotions for a minute then, and then we can get maybe back to this this anger issue.
Because that's true, because you really have to define what an emotion is at this point.
Exactly. And so what I do in the book is I've got a whole chapter just on, here's some of the state-of-the-art conversations on philosophy of emotion.
Mm-hmm.
So just here's some of the highlights. So an emotion is supposed to be some sort of mental state where it involves two components. It involves a cognitive component and an affective component. And so the cognitive component is your emotion is it's a way of representing the way the world is. So I look at a particular situation, you walk into the room and you see that there's glass is broken and you've got a mental representation of, you know, the glass has been broken, but you also have an evaluation of that situation too. You've evaluated that this glass is something that's valuable to me because it's my grandmother's glass. And you also evaluate this as having a particular kind of value of upsetting. And this is upsetting.
Mm.
Because there's a disvalue at play here, which is the disvalue of losing this valuable glass. And so that's all the cognitive aspect of it.
Right.
You're representing the situation a particular way.
Yes.
The affective component is there's something that it feels like to have that evaluation.
Okay.
And so that's all wrapped up in an emotion. So you walk in, you make the evaluation of the situation, and there's something that it feels like. You evaluate it to be upsetting because you make a judgment about the values at play. And then it feels a particular way. It feels upsetting. And so that's what an emotion is.
Mm-hmm.
But it could also have a positive because like it could be like you walk in the room and you're like, oh, you like made me like breakfast or something.
Mm-hmm.
And you could be like, well, that makes me happy. So it could be, it doesn't have to be an upsetting one because you're like, this is something that is valuable and I deem it to be exciting or nice, pleasant.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have a pleasant or pleasurable affect because it's something that's what it feels like to have that evaluation.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so these emotions, one of the things that's interesting is when you get into the 20th century, a lot of philosophers start re-emphasizing this cognitive aspect of emotions because they don't think it's just pushes and pulls. They don't think it's just bodily sensations because like, say like my toe itches or my nose itches or whatever. They're like, that's not an emotion. That is an affective state because it's just something that it feels like.
Yeah.
But it's not about anything in the way that seeing this glass broken is.
Mm-hmm.
And so Martha Nussbaum, she'll point out that she's like, emotions can't just be these jabs and stabs or pulls that you feel in your body. Because she's like, one of the things that makes emotions like so like amazing or also so like horrific and tormenting is the psychological aspect to it. Like,
yes, they really pull at you mentally. They really stick to you.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just like you have that feeling and it goes away. It can come back to you. So mm-hmm. I think it's much more deep.
Yes.
Yeah.
It really gets at you mentally.
Yes.
And that is one of the things that kind of got lost a little bit at different points in the history of philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And so the latter half of the 20th century was going, we need to focus again on that cognitive aspect.
Okay.
And it wasn't lost in like previous generations of theologians or philosophers, but it kind of got lost a bit in the 20th century. And so it was kind of like, let's bring this back. Let's get back at this idea of emotions are cognitive. They're about something in the world. And they're connected to other issues. So one, they're connected with two other things, one of which is truth and another which is morality. So they're connected to truth because your emotions are evaluating the world. They're representing the world a particular way. And if your emotion doesn't accurately represent the world a particular way, then your emotion is subject to being corrected. I could tell you, you've got the wrong emotion. So for instance, say you walk in the room and you perceive that I've broken this valuable glass from your grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, no, it's not. It's actually just some other random glass. So chill out. Like,
yes.
You know, you might not like hearing me tell you to chill out at that moment. Just the fact that I can correct you on your emotion doesn't mean I always should because it might not go well.
Sounds pretty accurate. Yeah.
Right. But once you fully accept that it's not really your grandmother's glass, then you would calm down and be like, oh, okay.
That's good. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
I get better.
Yeah. And there's lots of things, we do this all the time. Like there's this common phrase in English, which is there's no use in crying over spilt milk. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not that big of a deal. You know, calm down.
Yeah.
And then we also have a lot of times in the current culture where people are like, why are you not outraged by like what's happening in the news right now? And I'm like, are you telling me what emotions I should feeling? And they're like, why are you not outraged by what's happening in the news right now?
So it goes in both ways.
Oh, it goes all over the place. Yeah.
Like, calm down and like you should be outraged.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so the idea is that if your emotion is not properly tracking what's going on in reality, then your emotion is... It's not really true. It's not really truly representing what's going on in the world.
Okay, yes. Mm-hmm.
And so your emotions can then be justified by, you know, what you're seeing, by the evidence that you have. And so there is this relationship between truth and your emotions. Your emotions are subject to being true or false. They're subject to correction. They are subject to, you know, accurately representing the world. Mm-hmm. And this is what's going on. Now, where morality comes into play is because your emotions are evaluations of the situation. So you evaluate the glass, like, it might not be a moral issue, but when I, like, talk about the news example, like, you should be outraged by what's happening in the news, that's usually a moral claim. Like, you should have a moral evaluation of the situation. And this has long been noticed by lots of philosophers throughout history. So Aquinas, for example, he says that imagine somebody witnesses a truly awful, tragic event. And then he's like, imagine that this person sees a truly horrible thing, really evil event, but they're not disturbed by it.
Yeah, they just take a selfie of it.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. What are you going to think about that kind of person?
I don't know. I mean, please don't let me say this.
Sure. I'll tell you what Aquinas says then instead. So you
thank
don't have
you.
To like,
thank yeah. you.
So Aquinas says, if someone witnesses a truly like awful thing, but they're not disturbed by it, he's like, well, then there's something morally wrong with them.
I agree with that.
Yeah. And so he's like, there's a couple options. Maybe like they're not disturbed by it because they're ignorant.
Right.
Like they don't know all the moral facts.
Sure.
And so they see this horrible thing and they're not bothered by it. And he's like, well, maybe they don't know all the moral facts. So they need more moral knowledge. So like give them an education and be like, here's what's right or wrong. This is why this is tragic. Mm-hmm. And once they have that moral knowledge, then Aquinas is like, hopefully then they'll be disturbed.
Yes. They wouldn't know what to do with that.
Right. And then he's like, but there's some other options, though. Another option is maybe they do have enough moral knowledge, but they don't care.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I feel so relatable.
Right.
With things that I'm seeing online. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So sometimes people, they just don't care.
Yeah. They're just like, I just want to take this picture. Mm-hmm. Isn't it that cool? Oh, that guy's dead. But I'm in the picture.
But I got a great selfie, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so Aquinas would be like, well, in that case, you've got a moral character that is just awful.
Yes.
And so you do have the right kind of moral knowledge, but you don't have the right cares or concerns. Mm-hmm. Because your emotions are always grounded in your cares and concerns. Because your emotions aren't just simply evaluations. They are grounded in what you care about. And what you care about is what is worthy of your attention and worthy of your action. You think it's worth paying attention to. You think it's worthy of acting on behalf of. So your emotions, if they're not grounded in the right cares and concerns, things that you really think are worthy of action and worthy of thinking about and reflecting on, then Aquinas is like, you need a whole different kind of moral education.
Oh, God. So if you're a very shallow person, you're going to be very shallow emotion.
Exactly.
Oof.
Right.
That's gross.
Exactly. And so you need to have not just be emotional. So this is something like this contemporary philosopher named Robert Roberts. I don't know why his parents named him Robert Roberts, but, you know.
It's a damn much fun.
I'm not going to make an evaluation of that situation. but he's a brilliant philosopher. I'll make that evaluation. And so Robert Roberts says you've got some people who are emotionally shallow because their emotions, what they care about, what they're concerned with. It's really fleeting stuff. It's really shallow stuff. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you want emotions that are really deep, that you have deep emotions. Not just that you feel them really deeply, but that like you really care about the right sort of things.
Yes, but okay. This is a very slippery slope. Mm. Because if I constantly feel other people feel, I won't be able to do anything else.
You won't be able to function.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, something I do not talk about in the book, but that I read quite a bit about, is that humans, like, they have a very limited range of how much they can empathize with. Mm-hmm. Because empathy is really emotionally and mentally taxing. It's hard
draining.
For us to do.
It's absolutely draining.
It really is.
Yes.
And it's something that you can get really good at, that it becomes like a second nature to you. But that's what Aquinas says you need. So like, if you've got this sort of like, you just don't care about this kind of situation, you know it's right or wrong, but like, you just don't care. Then Aquinas is like, you need a different moral character. You need a different second nature.
Okay.
And when the more you empathize with people, the more you get at it, you develop that virtue or that second nature. It becomes second nature to you.
So it's going to make you a better person.
It makes you a better person. So in Aquinas' view.
Okay, so can this be applied to God?
This is what's weird, because Aquinas does not apply it to God.
What?
Right. I know.
How?
This is something that Nicholas Wolterstorff points out. So Nicholas Wolterstorff's like, Aquinas has got this really interesting view of like emotions and morality and virtues and all that. And then he's like, does he apply to God? Well, is God disturbed by anything that happens in the world? According to Aquinas, no, because God's perfectly happy all the time.
Yes.
And so you're like, well, then but on your own moral theory, then God should be this horrible monster.
Exactly. Yeah. It feels like, no, you're definitely missing something.
Yes.
But the other thing would be like, God is like 100% morally great. Mm-hmm. So you cannot go beyond.
Correct.
So it won't add anything to it.
It wouldn't affect him in any way. But if you really think that if a perfectly virtuous person is going to be disturbed by seeing something awful, and then you're like, God's perfectly virtuous, well, then it just follows. It has to be the case that God should be disturbed by seeing something awful. But if he's not, then you're like, well, then he's just not perfectly virtuous. Or being perfectly virtuous means something completely different than what you told me, you know, Mr. Aquinas. So it's got to be something different.
So this was like roughly the introduction of your book.
Yeah, so these are things I get into in the first and second chapter. Yeah.
Okay, okay. This is very interesting. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
And there you have it, another episode of the Reluctant Theologian Podcast. Stay tuned for more episodes on God and emotion.